Welcome to Bad Science, the show that breaks down the science of a movie with a comedian and a scientist. Today we're discussing After Earth. So I'll ask about biomimicry, fearlessness, and quote, bingo power. But first, a short word from our sponsor.
Bad Science. Did the movie get it right? Bad Science. Or will we have to fight?
Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Ethan Edinburgh, and I've got two wonderful guests joining me today. First up, he's an astrobiofuturist, an inventor, an immersive storyteller, and he co-hosts the TV series Little Giants on Animal Planet. Welcome to the show, Billy Allman.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Billy. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
Billy, you are certified in biomimicry, which I mentioned earlier. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so biomimicry is this approach to innovation and problem solving, where we are studying the natural strategies, the adaptations that organisms on this planet use to solve various challenges. And we essentially understand the underlying mechanisms and strategies in their biology that allow them to solve these problems, and then apply those things to coming up with designs and innovations that apply to human problems that are similar to the same challenges these animals are solving for.
Okay. Unbelievable. I love this field. And can you give me an example of one of those things?
So one of the most readily identifiable examples of biomimicry is Velcro. So the guy who invented Velcro was this Swedish inventor, and he would always take his dog for walks through the forest, and he would always notice when they came back that the dog had these little spherical seeds that were stuck to its fur. And one day he took the seed and looked at it under a microscope and saw that it had all these little curly Q little hooks on the end of it. And he thought, well, this would be a great way to attach things, because that is the underlying mechanism that the seed uses to propagate itself. So the seed has these curly little Q hooks on the end, so that when animals are traveling through the forest, it can latch onto the fur of those animals and essentially get an Uber ride to a place that might be ideal for this seed to fall off and eventually sprout into a plant and a tree. And from that, he was like, this is dope. I think I can make something out of this. And from that little curly Q little seed known as a burr seed, we have Velcro.
Wow.
And now you can get thrown up against a wall and stick to that wall.
Right. With your friends.
Through his technology.
Exactly.
Thank you, biomimicry.
Yes. And thank you, dog. And thank you, Swedish. Swedish inventor.
I think his name was Mr. Velcro.
Mr. Velcro. Sorry, yeah. It's my hip-hop horn.
No, that's great. Please actually continue doing that throughout the podcast.
I will hold you to that.
Okay, but please do. That second voice you heard is our other guest. He is an actor and YouTuber you might have seen on shows like Shameless and The Rookie. And earlier today, he lost a dramatic overtime tennis match with a heartbreaking final score of 8-6. It's Will Westwater.
Oof, with an intro like that. The saddest thing about our tennis game today, Ethan, was that I lost on a second serve. I hit the net.
That's right.
On the second serve. And that was
double faulted.
Yeah, double faulted for you know, game, set, match. Ugh.
Yeah.
Other than that, great rallies. Great rallies.
It was a great game. Wonderful to play with you. Wonderful to have you on the podcast. And I mean, now your day must be getting much better because you get to talk to Billy.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited. I'm curious to see what you thought, especially, you know, God, when so much about this movie is about adaptation on Earth and how these organisms have adapted and how humans have adapted to figure out how to deal with these other organisms on the other planet and all that other stuff. But yeah, I'm really excited. Great to meet you, Billy.
Yeah, to piggyback on that, I think that's a great place to start, Will. Like, how did you feel? What was your emotional experience and your logical mind experience watching this movie, Billy?
I honestly had big hopes when it first came out because the trailer was awesome. The trailer was like, okay, you know, it's Will Smith and his son going on a father-son trip through space.
Mm-hmm.
And oh no, stuff goes down, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, it's been a while since we've had like Will Smith in kind of a Independence Day kind of role. So I was excited in general. And then I saw the film, and then I heard the accents that they chose to use, and then I was just like, okay.
Where were those accents from? Do you know?
I don't know.
Ugh, the accents. Really quickly.
Please, break it down.
Pull you out of everything. All right, so for those who may not have seen this movie, The accents are totally made up because it's this, you know, colony after Earth, after we've left Earth and we've gone to, what was it?
Nova Prime.
Nova Prime.
It's a Nova Prime accent, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like, it's like Andy, my girlfriend, looked it up as we were watching because we immediately...
Great.
It distracts you. It makes you stop and go, what are... what? And it's like a mix of like Mid-Atlantic, South African, and I think... like some other, anyway, but regardless, it's just, it makes you ask questions. It makes you Google things. It makes you stop the movie.
Right.
An interesting artistic choice.
Yeah. Don't make your audience Google, I guess, is a good rule.
Yeah.
Accents were weird. How did you feel about how the Earth was portrayed?
I thought it was interesting. So, you know, in preparation for this, obviously I cheated a little bit, did some research.
No, I love that. That's the opposite of cheating. That's like extra credit. That's really cool.
Okay, I'll take
gold
it.
Star. Gold star, Billy. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the minute that that baboon popped up, all hulked out, I'm like, okay, this is interesting. And then they're like, this is Earth, right? Like, that's my sample of the accent. This is Earth,
yeah.
Right? With the, yeah. I guess that's U-T-H is how you spell it. to nail the accent, Earth. Then they're like, okay, this is 1,000 years after they've left. So it would take about 500,000 to 5 million years for new species to evolve.
Mm.
So, you know, to have these roided out baboons show up.
That hunt in packs. They hunt in packs too. Is that?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
They're like smart, like they organized.
Yeah. So it's pretty implausible the extreme changes that those organisms went through to be, you know, as different as they were.
Mm.
So that right there, like that puts you in a category of, okay, this is not sci-fi, this is fantasy.
Would you rather they have gone somewhere else? Like, could you just have called this planet a different name and like a lot of the issues would be solved for you?
I think if it was a different planet, yes, but then you'd have to go back and change the name of the film, right?
Well, just right. Call it After Earth, U-T-H.
Yeah, no one will know what you're talking about.
Yeah, whatever.
The thing is, I like the overall premise of we're going back to Earth and, you know, things have changed. But I think it kind of moved so much into parody because of those changes,
right,
that it might as well have been another planet.
Yeah, I feel like, first of all, 1,000 years, and also the fact that the gravity is different than what they're used to on Nova Prime, although that is brought up and then kind of tossed aside immediately.
Yeah.
Never really followed up on.
Mm-hmm. He feels heavier.
Yeah, he feels heavier and then doesn't for the rest of the movie other than that time.
Well, then he mans up, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a good point because, I mean, one, I didn't see them like pass the moon or anything like that on their way crashing into the planet. And it's not like the planet grew to the size of Jupiter or shrunk. So, yeah, the gravity thing it seems pretty preposterous.
I mean, the big one for me was the planet freezing over. Just because I felt like, I'll buy that it freezes over. That's fine. But that it freezes over every night and then thaws out every morning felt a little bit like, okay, now you're pushing it.
Well,
you're pushing
me. And that,
don't push me.
Yeah, I thought they were pushing it ever since Will Smith got ripped out of that freaking ship, and then he's like still alive. Everybody's dead but him.
Okay, that's actually a great point because in that shot, when he falls out, I don't think he, like, the tail end of the ship disappears, right? It breaks off, but I don't think he's in it while it breaks off.
Right?
I thought it broke away and then he like fell out the ship.
It looked like he got sucked out.
Yeah. Right?
Yep. That's what it looked like to me.
So, yeah, that's, you know, strike two.
Yeah, right, exactly. Implausibility. We're going to make a list.
What about the thing becoming Ice Age every night?
Oh,
I mean, is that wacko psycho, or am I off kilter here?
No, I mean, there's extremes. You know, there's definitely places on this planet that have temperature change extremes, right? Like, it happens in the desert, not necessarily to that extreme. So those swings are not out of the norm, but the extent, the hyperbole that they went to for it does not make a lot of sense. And
that the whole planet freezes over.
No. And also,
and that the flora and fauna would have to deal with that too.
Exactly. Mm. So all of these plants and animals that you're seeing survive this extreme freeze, if we can't survive it to a very large extent, none of these things would have been able to make it either.
And all those plants, the fact that they close up, you're like, yeah, but that doesn't solve
right
the fact that you are clearly a tropical plant and now everything's freezing and everything's like, it's not, these aren't evergreens when he's running through that forest and it's starting to freeze.
Exactly. Like, and think of the humidity.
It looks like he's in the Amazon. Yeah.
Think of the humidity, right, that you would have to experience of that warming up, of all of that moisture. Like, he would have lost like 10 pounds of sweat just in running a couple of miles from those hulked out baboons. So, this the more we talk about it, the more I realize how preposterous and ridiculous this whole movie really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was hard to avoid. But I will say, while watching it, I was like, plenty to talk about, though, for the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. I do have a question for Billy.
Kick it.
The excretion of pheromones.
That's a big one.
Do we have fear pheromones? I don't know if you're qualified to answer that.
So wait, let me set this up, Will. So if you haven't seen it, the aliens in the movie release the Ursa. Now, I know what you're thinking. Is the Ursa also an alien? I think so. So I'm not sure why there's a difference there in terminology, but okay. The aliens, who I don't know what they do or what they look like, drop the Ursa, the creature that they have bred to kill humans. That thing is blind, but can smell our fear. And so I guess, A, the aliens are like bad at killing humans. Did you guys get that vibe? Like, they can't do it themselves. And then also, like, the human race just didn't figure out that these things are blind and like how to not have them smell us or smell our fear, I guess. But yeah, anyways, that same guy you were talking about before, the Game of Thrones guy, is like describing what happens when you're afraid. And he says that adrenaline's pumping through your blood and that your heart beats faster and your pores open up and secrete pheromones that tell it that we're afraid. Is that how it works?
So there's a study called Interspecies Transmission of Emotional Information via Chemo Signals from Humans to Dogs.
Whoa.
And in this, essentially, the study finds that dogs can smell human emotions and respond accordingly. So, you know, when a person gets scared, there's sweat glands that start secreting moisture. And, you know, this sweat, it contains chemical signals that dogs can pick up on.
Damn.
So there's precedent for the idea of it. I personally, when it comes to like turning on and off fear, so one, there's a difference between fear and anxiety, but the reactions that our bodies have in terms of like kind of triggering our fight, flight, or freeze response is rooted kind of, there's a lot of similarities there. But the idea of like turning off something that is so hardwired in our biology, I kind of find a little iffy. But if you intellectualize fear the way that I feel like they did in the film, then yeah, I guess you could turn off your fear, but I don't think you can turn off your body's response to how we perceive threats.
Wow.
Wow. So I'm going to put that in the win column only because it's a little bit more plausible than the 1,000-year transformation. And at least it's some sort of idea that might, like, theoretically could happen, but the fear response thing is in the loss column. So we're now at 1 win, 3 losses.
Yeah. Damn.
For realisticness.
Day of losing for you.
Right?
Taking that L.
I'm familiar with losing today.
That's right. A huge theme in this movie is fear. I want to hear what each of you are most afraid of right after this break.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
We're back, and to quote Will Smith in After Earth, fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not, at present, and may never exist. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. Were you just saying before the break, Billy, that you don't believe that, or do you think that if you intellectualize it like he does, if you truly believe that, you could walk around life fearless? No dog could smell your fear stench.
Well, I think that if you conflate fear and anxiety, to around like a perceived threat, then I think it's very hard to turn off fear. But if you separate like how we respond when our bodies perceive, or when we perceive a threat, which is hardwired into our biology, which is also rooted in, you know, our brains and how our brains work in terms of pattern recognition, right? And how we process information, how we, you know, we try to, our brains kind of shortcut a lot of processing by, you know, forming these patterns of things that we've seen before. And then we make quick decisions based on those patterns, right? That's where like a lot of, you know, unconscious bias and things like that come from, right? Mm-hmm. So if there's certain things that you've previously been afraid of, that your body, you know, responds to those things, you know, you have to train yourself to kind of unprocess those patterns. And so I think in that way, you can train yourself to not be afraid of things. But I think like the idea of, you know, being in front of an alien creature that's only purpose is to kill you, and 5 minutes of meditation in the moment will cure you of sweating and your system kind of doing its kind of automatic processing. I think that's a very hard thing to do personally.
That makes sense. Do you have those patterns still, or have you meditated enough to break them?
Well, lately I haven't been around enough killer alien blind creatures.
Oh no!
So I'm below my quotient on meditative fear practices.
Does Zoloft count?
I don't know. Can I say what counts? Is that for me to do?
It reduces the adrenaline response. Certainly chills me out.
Are you running from aliens? I guess it would be the question. Do you have?
No, I'm just running from day-to-day anxiety.
Ah, got it. Makes more sense. Okay, I was going to ask also if we had other places to live. Like, we go to Nova Prime, quote-unquote, in this movie. I mean, where do you think we would go if, you know, scientists told us, like, hey, we got 10 years, pack up your shit, and let's move?
Yeah, so for me, so right now there's a lot of buzz around going to Mars and going to the moon, all these really great conversations, a lot of really great innovations and, you know, things are happening. And there's this really great book by this brilliant man named Frank White called The Overview Effect. And it talks about the experience that astronauts have when they go into space and they get the opportunity to see Earth from space, something that, you know, very few people have ever got to experience, and this kind of psychological impact that it has on you know, kind of how they define themselves and see themselves and see humanity and see how fragile the world is. So to answer your question, for me, I think the safest place for us to go, the cheapest place for us to go, is to the moon and set up moon bases, because in the interim of trying to figure out like where the next Earth is, you know, we could still make some trips back to Earth, pick up some groceries before we decide where we're finally going to go. Mm-hmm. And you also have the benefit of seeing the moon. One thing, there's a lot of things that people don't necessarily realize that kind of get lost in the romanticism of traveling to other planets. And, you know, Mars is farther away from the sun, so there's not necessarily the same amount of sunlight. There's no atmosphere on Mars, so the idea of living in a glass bubble where there's all of these, you know, snowstorms and radiation that we're not being protected from above the surface doesn't make that like a sexy thing.
No.
So most likely people living on Mars are probably going to be living in lava tubes beneath the surface. So that'll be fun. Imagine living in a cave, right?
Oh my God. Lava tubes also? Is that the name of that?
Yeah, exactly.
Also known as warp pipes.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the like plausibility of actually living there, I agree with you that I think it should be some sort of like a stopping point before going to something else. Because the thing that this movie assumes that we already have like interstellar travel, that we mm-hmm. can, you know, they kind of, it looked like they almost went into a black hole and kind of jumped, like kind of like with the Interstellar, where you almost just enter this like
a wormhole.
This wormhole, yeah, it looked like a wormhole. But if we don't have those, the distances, I mean, I may be an actor, but I know that at least it's ridiculous, the distances from stuff that's outside of our solar system. You're talking about years and years and years and years and years to get anywhere. Whatever sort of speed we have.
There's this organization and this effort that was launched by NASA. And I know that the astronaut Mae Jemison was also heavily involved in exploring it. And I think she was leading a lot of the work called the 100-Year Starship. And it was essentially an exploration of, like, what would it actually take for us to get to, you know, the next solar system. I want to say it was the next solar system, or the closest planet in our neighboring solar system, I want to say. And, you know, it takes all of these generations. Like, people are going to live and die on these spaceships until we have that level of technology. So there's people who, you know, imagine being the middle child in terms of, like, generations, right? You have the generation who leaves, who are on the starship. You have the generation that are born and die on the starship. And then you have, like, the last generation who gets off the starship and finds the planet, right? Imagine being stuck, and all you know, you're the middle child generations of just living on this spaceship, and that's all you know. But you hear all of these stories of what Earth was like from these previous generations. That was something I was talking to someone about. And, you know, it's just... I love space exploration, but there's so much that people like romanticize that when you really think about it, it totally falls flat in terms of its appeal.
Yeah, I think there's certainly room for both, because I, especially watching movies like this, it's a really quick way to see both sides of the fence. It's like, on one hand, space is unbelievable, and what could possibly be more interesting than, on the other hand, the entire process of getting out into space and traveling to Mars, and the whole thing seemed like a nightmare.
Well, and just to paint a picture of what most likely, a couple of details of for the like the first couple of people traveling to Mars are going to experience, especially if it's like by a government agency. So from here to Mars is, you know, depending on like when you leave and all that kind of stuff, it's like 6 to 8 month trip, right? Mm-hmm. Inside a steel tube with, let's say, 4 to 6 other people. When you also think about the fact, like, you're drinking each other's pee, essentially.
Wait.
Right? Of course, it's, you know, it's filtered and all that.
What do you mean, essentially? It's filtered? How?
I mean, just because everything has to be a closed-looped system. You know, you have to recycle everything.
What about poop?
Poop gets freeze-dried, right? Like in the Martian.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Turn into soil?
Yeah, yeah. It's freeze-dried. So it's, you know, they're still working on, like, how that, you know, systems that can... essentially process all of that over and over again. But, you know, traveling to space right now is all about essentialism. Like, what do we absolutely need to get there, do our job, and get back safely, right? So, you know, essentially you're stuck in a metal tube traveling, you know, 17,000 plus miles or however fast it is for 6 to 8 months. You know, with the knowledge that you're drinking the pee of the people that you might like actually come to hate over that period of time, and you're not allowed to drink alcohol, right?
Ooh, didn't know that one.
So, well, I mean, at least for, you know, a lot of the government astronauts right now, right? Like, you don't want, plus you don't want anybody with a hangover like flying a rocket into a planet that has no atmosphere, right?
That's a good call, yeah.
So. Yeah. So, you know, think about that, and you know, a lot of astronauts have commented on how boring it can be in space. So there's all these psychological things.
Yeah.
I don't even know where I was going with all that, but...
You're painting a beautiful, terrifying picture.
Right? Yeah, like, I feel like we had a tiny, tiny fraction of what all of those people would have to go through in being in our homes for an entire year.
Right.
But no one really seemed happy on After Earth. Everybody on the ship seemed pretty miserable. So,
I mean, look at the seats they were using. That sucks.
Right?
Yeah.
His bed's a hammock, Will.
Yeah, I feel like everything was a hammock, or it was made of like...
Everything's a hammock in this
everything's
movie.
A hammock. It looks like it was made of spider webs everywhere. Jaden Smith's room has all sorts of stuff going on. He looks like he's like a healer in this village.
Yeah, you're
all
right.
All sorts of like vials and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always just wondering what all that stuff is.
You know, I was curious about that too. I was trying to understand, you know, because clearly, okay, it was kind of an arid landscape, right? And, you know, they were using wind farming. So, okay, there's a lot of wind. It looked kind of arid and dry. Not a lot of vegetation, but there was like that huge like terrarium with air plants from Earth in it, which I was like, okay.
Everybody talks weird.
Everybody talks weird. It's probably because they don't have enough nutrition because, you know, they're just eating air plants.
Mm-hmm. I wish they just did what they did in Halo, where it's like just a coalition of people from all over the world. Like 1,000 years, sure, things would change, but I feel like you'd still have, I don't know.
It's a just, greenhouse?
The accents.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still stuck on that.
I'm with you. The Expanse is a way better space show, by the way. Mm.
The Expanse.
Well, it's not a movie, but
no. Hey, I'll check it out. That sounds great.
Yeah.
You guys have got to watch The Expanse.
Stop watching After Earth so many times and watch The Expanse.
Yes.
Great.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break and we'll be right back.
The break is over. Here we go back to the show about science.
Okay, I wanted to ask about the ionic layer that causes electrical interference that the volcano blasts out. Do you know about that? Did that ring true to you?
So I can't say that I'm overly familiar with like a lot of the science of all that went into that, but it did seem like, bro, you're flying pretty close to what are undoubtedly some toxic fumes coming out of that volcano. So if you can't breathe from your two little, you know, plastic Danish air things.
Right. IKEA air filter.
Yeah. Right.
Whatever that was.
His little vape pods.
Vape pods.
I don't see how you could survive, you know, the air already being hard for you to breathe and then breathing in these chemicals while flying and avoiding creatures.
Well, what about the signal part of it? Like to me, I thought it was kind of weird that like he has to go to these fumes to get better Wi-Fi?
Oh yeah, that doesn't make sense at all.
That's when it works.
It's like, oh, let me hold my phone up.
Yeah, and he's holding it up.
Get better
right.
reception.
He's holding it up like everybody used to do.
The best
and we
reception
thought
is by this cloud of toxic smoke.
It doesn't look like an Ethernet booster. The volcano. It looks like it would disturb your signal. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Can we talk about his staff? Because that was cool.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
That was cool.
That was really
Although,
cool.
I got to point out, I want to say, when he gives it to him, he says, like, there's 24 alterations or something. And then, like, we don't see it change that much, bro.
No, we don't. No. We really don't. I wanted to see, like, more fun stuff with that.
Right.
I did, too.
I loved how he, like, jammed it up above and it, like expanded into the rock as he climbed up.
Yeah.
That was pretty, like... There were plenty of cool moments in this movie. I really also like, you know, as in terms of like biomimicry, his suit changes to whatever situation he's in.
Yeah, sort of. Yes. Sometimes it does. I felt like sometimes the suit was either lazy or didn't realize what was going on.
Right? Yeah.
And clearly they didn't have any jobs. I mean, they were just practicing on these blind animals and wind farms and making suits that don't work. You had one job to do. You had one job.
Right, and the suits are only used to Nova Prime.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was they cast like one of the most charismatic actors in one of the least charismatic parts.
Oh, yeah.
Like Will Smith plays like the just most like...
Robot dad.
Robot dad. Yeah, exactly.
A little bit of robot
totally
dad.
Just like an army guy.
Yeah, that's true. I have to bring this up, Billy. You've had an unbelievable past. We could do a whole podcast on what you've done, where you've been. But I would get yelled at by my producer, Emily, if I didn't bring it up. You worked as an Imagineer. Is that correct?
Yes.
What? Lee, I don't want you to get sniped out by, you know, secret ops or whatever. But what can you tell me about this experience?
I would say that working as a theme park designer, as an immersive experience designer, Or as a designer who does immersive experiences for theme parks, however you want to cut it up, is by far one of the coolest jobs I've ever had. And there's amazing people that work there, and there's this culture of, you know, Walt Disney has this quote of, it's kind of fun to do the impossible, and people that work there live in that. So if you've ever been to one of those theme parks, you get to experience the, you know, for lack of a better word, the magic of people in their daily work making the impossible happen. And it's so cool because it's like being on a campus where you're working with really talented engineers and artists on the same project. And so I think that's what the end result is. It's this really artistic, scientific masterpiece that people get to experience from all over the world, which is, it's really cool.
Yeah, that sounds unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a big fan. Anything you'd like to promote, tell people about, let people know. I mean, I've had a wonderful time talking with you. I hope we speak again, but where can people follow you, Billy?
Yeah, thank you. Likewise. So one thing I will say is I do a lot of public speaking and I love talking to students about biomimicry and about, you know, what I refer to as the nature of space, or how nature can be found in space, how nature is inspiring space exploration, and how space has already influenced so much of our lives, right? Like, we are able to do this podcast from all of the various places that we live because of space exploration. We have cameras in our cell phones that, you know, allow us to, you know, capture, you know, not only special moments, but very needed moments of, you know, social justice because of space exploration. So if anyone's looking for me, you can either go to my website, billyallman.com, or you can find me on Instagram at @billy_allman, A-L-M-O-N.
Unbelievable. And you are creating and manning your own spaceship from the outside of your house, is that correct? In your backyard, you're blasting yourself off into space by yourself.
I am working towards eventually. I do want to own a space farm. So part of being an astrobiofuturist is the future part, and I think that people are going to need to eat in space. So that's a long term project that I am actually working on.
Do space farms already exist?
I would say that methods of food production, there's actually a NASA proposal out now where they're looking for people to think of new ways to prepare and craft food for space exploration. You know, it's right now it tends to be a lot of food rations and, you know, freeze-dried stuff and processed stuff like that. So it's something that people are working on now. Another thing in this particular context that came out from space exploration are vertical farms. You know, hydroponics is something that you can tie a path back to space exploration with. So definitely, yeah, space gardens, be on the lookout.
That sounds great. That sounds like a great movie also.
Right?
Space farm, oh, I like space that. Gardens. I'm into that. Honestly, even if it was just a real life place that we could go here in L.A., to just look at, you know, like a space-themed garden or a space-themed botanical place. That even sounds... I'll sign up for that.
I'm just really happy that, you know, NASA has been kind of pushing more video on their most recent Mars trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's spreading around to social media, because I think that's the kind of stuff that is going to inspire, you know, the next generation. Because at some point, we are going to figure, I think, a lot of this stuff out. And it does take crazy dreamers just trying stuff, understanding the odds, but still going. And I think there's literally infinite possibilities. Like, I really, I don't know. And you think about some of the great minds that we have that have worked on some of this stuff and have theorized, and I don't know. I just think it's only a matter of time. So,
well, Will, what do you got? I mean, how should we bring more food up to space? Let's just try and, you know, rattle off like 5 to 10 ideas.
Oh, man. I mean, well, first of all, I watched a Vsauce video on space elevators that was really good. and how just really hard that would be. I don't know. I think in terms of big space travel, we need to figure out either how to move really fast or how to, you know, create something that can fold the space time, you know, that gravity, you know, folding in space or whatever it
does. Well, sure, but I like food. So if you had a big one food item to go with you to space, what would you pick?
Oh boy, I would say hibachi chicken and fried rice from Benihana.
Wow.
Or like your
hibachi grill.
Grill. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like an hibachi restaurant. It's family style. We have a good time.
Nice.
Billy, wait, what about you? What are you bringing to space? You got one item.
Oh man. You know, of course I have to say my wife's cooking, but That's a you know, I have to say that.
Well, and that's a good cheat answer, because that kind of gets you like a bunch of items.
Right? Yeah. Well, if I couldn't take my wife's
cooking. You can't wish for 1,000 wishes, okay, Billy?
So my backup answer is Chipotle.
Honestly,
it's so funny that you both said like a big name. You didn't just name like cheeseburger in general. It was like, no, Chipotle specifically, that's what you want.
It's the same burrito every day. I could do it.
What do you order?
Rice. Okay, so it's burrito, white rice. Sometimes I'll say heavy rice so I can get extra rice without them charging me. I've had a very bad pandemic, you guys. Like, I'm stress eating like crazy.
I mean, you just said the words heavy rice.
Don't worry.
So white rice, half chicken, half steak.
Yep.
A little bit of sour cream, guacamole and cheese and corn.
No lettuce,
and then the vinaigrette on the side.
And the vinaigrette on the side.
And then my version of a Diet Coke for that is a kombucha.
Oh, so you bring your own.
Balance it out.
Little booch.
Oh yeah. Go head on down to the CVS, grab me a kombucha, and
that's what you tell the Chipotle employee.
That's it. Yeah.
I'll have a kombucha too. They're like, we don't sell that, sir. You're like, no. Go get me a kombucha. I will pay you for it.
The customer's right. Always right.
Space Uber Eats.
Okay, Will.
Yeah.
What about you, my friend? Where can people find you? What's your YouTube channel? I know you've got.
Yeah. So my YouTube channel, I help actors and I never charge them for it, which is really cool. It's on just YouTube, Will Westwater, for all your acting needs. And then you can follow me on Instagram, where I don't really talk as much about acting and more just, it's just me, at Willie Dubs, Willie with a Y, Dubs with a D, or whoops, Dubs with a Z, but also with a D. So Willie Dubs.
Great.
On Instagram.
Thank you for being here, Willie Dubs.
No problem.
Willie Dubs.
Billy Allman, you as well. I had a great time, and yeah, hopefully we can, find some other, maybe we'll talk about The Expanse. Yeah. Maybe I'll check that out for
right?
next time.
Yeah, I would totally revisit on another movie.
I love it. This was awesome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Great to meet you, Billy.
Likewise.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bad Science is a Seeker podcast produced by Emily Feld and me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our editor is Lucas Bollinger, and our social media is managed by Blue Whale Media. Shout out to EJ and Kate.
And the executive Nova Prime Deucer is Brett Kushner.
Oh, follow us on Instagram at BadSciencePod. If there's a movie you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, feel free to email at badscience@seeker.com. That's badscience@seeker.com. And please leave us an iTunes review. Give us 5 stars. I sound like an Uber driver, but it does help. It makes sure people know about the podcast, which we really appreciate. Thanks for listening. Bye.